Everything is theoretically impossible until it is done. Robert A. Heinlein. Welcome back to Book Wave, the book club podcast. We're back for another Wavecast. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Pat.
Yo.
Will.
Hello.
Jason.
Hey, how's it going?
And the new face around here, Tim.
Hello.
All right, today we're talking about, you know, science fiction authors, self-help, you know, whatever's really on our minds. So why don't you start us off, Will?
Why do you always throw the ball at me?
I don't know, I'm just picking a name.
All right.
I pick someone different every time.
So I have a quote here from, I think, John Verveke's Awakening from the Meaning Crisis series.
Oh, yes.
Where in a bit of a huff, he yells, "Don't tell me what you believe, tell me what you practice." And I've had that quote sort of sitting under my monitor for the past couple weeks, and it's really starting to resonate with me the more I look at it, especially now because I'm doing my 200 hours yoga teacher training course, and I skipped the first yoga philosophy section. There's like 51 hour videos on yoga philosophy, and I jumped into the self-practice section. Self-practice is something that's really important to me, and it's something that gets overlooked a lot, and for very good reason. I think in this society, we're selling courses more than we are teaching, you know, anything. And so In the self-practice section, there was maybe four or five articles by these like mid-20s female white yoga instructors from California, which right away, if you can't tell, put a bad taste in my mouth. And they're very critical about these teachers who have their certification and they don't have a self-practice. They don't know how to make the time for self-practice. And they see us sort of training people that are memorizing Sanskrit pose names and sequences, and they're able to regurgitate that information, but they don't actually ever digest it. And for me, like with my yoga practice, I've been on and off for 10 years. When I got serious, I ordered textbooks from India, and I started studying. And I think that's one of my big problems, because in the West, we've got addiction and we've got enough streams of vices that you can escape and immerse yourself to the degree that you never grow up. And I think that we've normalized addiction to the point that it's okay to not grow up. We've got kids that are starting in video games at the age of 13. By the time they get out of their second career in their mid-30s, they realize they've got the emotional maturity of a 13-year-old. And for me, I get overwhelmed with the studying. That's how I escape. I think that I don't know enough. I feel like I'm an imposter and That I'm missing some sort of piece of the puzzle. And so for me, I know, like, I will sooner read 3,000 pages on yoga than get on my mat first thing in the morning. What do you guys think about that notion?
Does intellectual like learning engage you more than physical, like kinetic exercises or practices? In general, like for other things, does the learning about it tingle you a bit more than the actual like going out there and doing it sometimes?
I think it's one of those things where,
in general,
it's like that safety net, right? We were talking about it almost like a year ago, that whole notion of not even being able to leave your bed in the morning, because it's easier to reach my arm out and grab a book and escape for 3 hours than it is to stand up and get to the end of my bed where my mat is. And I'm definitely not an athletic person. I've always preferred reading, and I've got a photographic memory, so I retain everything that I read. So yeah, like generally intellectualizing and analyzing and introspectively losing myself is easier than doing the thing. But then the minute I do the thing, I obsess over it just as easily as the intellectualizing, right? Like I could do anything forever, but the minute I stop doing it, I lose interest in it. It's like, it's this weird reality we're in where we binge a season of a show and we're like, this is the greatest show ever, I want more of it. And then 2 months go by and we don't remember the plot of the show that we loved so much.
Yeah. Engaging the mind can burn calories just as much as exercise, as almost, you know, aerobic exercise, there's no replacement for it, but yeah, just reading a book there, you can really get your heart pumping to quite some extent, you know, if you really get engaged in a book, you can, and you can train your mind really just by imagination. But there's no, I feel like through facts that I've seen, is that it's like there's no replacement for actual practice, right? Where if you practice something, you'll get better. Where if you imagine it, you won't get worse, right? But you won't get better, so you'll kind of taper off, right? But if you practice, you'll start like increasing again.
Yeah, and I think both are
But
really
if you don't,
necessary.
yeah, and if you don't imagine it, you will decrease, you know. So if you don't keep it in your imagination, so like if you're I'm a drummer, you know, so if I air drum to things, then I don't get worse, I don't get better, you know. Like if I practice, I'll get better, but I don't get worse if I'm air drumming to things. But if I don't air drum and I don't think about drumming, then the neurons aren't getting their exercise. Like if I'm rolling over reading a book, you know, I get to exercise my imagination. So
I like to
where
add
would
on to the problems that we have here in the West of what Will just said in regards to
prediction?
addiction. This idea where we constantly learn something interesting, yet we don't do anything about it, that's a sign of infotainment to me, where we spend constant hours learning about something interesting. And we tell ourselves, yes, I want to put this into practice, yet we never do it. And if we do, we're just essentially selling off everything that we've learned from a particular subject for just profit. And, you know, we can be like all the other influential gurus and influencers, which I'm getting sick and tired of hearing. I mean, Jesus. And we never take the time to actually understand why we're doing it. And so I think that in order to go past this, we have to ask ourselves if this is truly what we want to do, whatever that might be. Like, for example, if you wanted to learn how to write a novel and you become fascinated with storytelling and you seriously want to put your own stories out there, you have to take in the time and energy to learn about plot lines and scene breaks and character development. And you can't just essentially take a three-act structure and then just blindly go through it as if you think you know everything about storytelling, when in actuality you don't.
Yeah, and there has to be like a trade-off there too, like some kind of sacrifice. Like if you want to really commit yourself to something, you have to kind of give up, you know, your hour and a half of watching cartoons at night. Give that up and instead just research storylines and plot structure and how to write a good character and actually spend the time writing too. Like you can't just say, I'm gonna decide to do this, and then not give up any of the other nonsense that you're so committed to.
And since there's so much information out there, you have to learn to break away from a lot of the knowledge and information that's out there. You just have to pick maybe one or two things and then just take it with you and go from there, because it can get overwhelming. It
It
certainly
sounds like you're
has.
talking about paralysis from information overload, and then also profiteering off of feeding back this information into little video segments, bite-sized for the masses, you know. And like I agree that's it's disgusting, and you can't do anything with them. You just gotta shoot them out back, you know, in the long 40. In the long 40. Really.
Muskoka proud.
You just gotta just keep moving forward with what you're doing, okay? Not worry about anybody else, kind of thing. And the information and the complaints that you have about the world, to record them for yourself and play them back, and you'll notice that the information being presented is information you'd like to give to yourself. So you package it in a way that's pointing out what's wrong with the world. And there's a lot wrong with the world, and the way we interpret it can be infinite. And the more eloquently we can point out what's wrong with the world to each other, you know, the better the world's going to get over time.
Yeah, or as Jordan Peterson would say, tell the truth, or at least don't lie. Articulate yourself properly. Speak your truth.
What do you think about all that, Synapsian, Jason, whatever your name is?
Well, if I may touch on that, on what Tim was talking about, information overload, you know, it's shown that when you have so many choices like we do, you can choose between this TV show, this book, this, you know, one of 100 different types of ketchup at the store, that kind of creates a paralysis where people don't know what to choose, or they feel that the choice they've made is inadequate. And so then they just don't, you know, ever develop a practice of being self-confident, and they kind of go from one thing to another, similar to what addiction is like. And I also wanted to pick up on something you said earlier, Will, about how we always want to, or not that we want to, but people tend to stay adolescent, or they never grow up. And I was thinking about this the other day, about how kids and adolescents eons ago were taught. They would have a mentor, they in a hunter-gatherer society, they would be surrounded by adults, and they would learn to do things by watching those adults. Yet the system we have going right now is adolescents learn from each other. You know, their adults are out there working jobs. The adolescents are in school together, so they're learning through peer taught practices. And, you know, if you're learning from another adolescent, how are you expected to mature if the other adolescents are acting juvenile?
I have the answer to that question, is that we're brains, right? And brains can do wonderful things, seemingly magical things, even untrained brains, especially when they're congregated, magic can happen. You know, movements can start. So there's no need to worry about the next generation. It's us that we got to worry about, and how are we going to move forward? How are we not going to be a shill for recycling information, repackaging it, and how are we going to move forward with bringing really good ideas to the table through denial and error? Being like, no, this is a really good idea, and it's just going to be like the most half-ass idea, and we got to refine each other. We got to use iron to sharpen iron here.
Yeah, like that's the route to take for like the realm of rationalism and science. But I think Synapsian was kind of touching on like emotional control for the youngins.
Very good.
So like,
yeah. So religion has been shown, any religion,
yeah,
any like any form of spirituality, religion kind of thing, of being reminded of one's own morals.
It's like Sunday school, right? Sunday school. Like
reminds you of your own morals.
My wife's grandmother very adamantly believes that Sunday school should be a thing that is still part of our society, because screw God, screw Jesus, screw Christians. It teaches you how to be a good human. It teaches you, like you're saying, morals. And Yeah. And that's the thing where, you know, this is my Sunday morning and this is my church, which is this podcast. But yeah. If we look at yesterday morning, I'm sure you all remember the phrase Saturday morning cartoons.
Oh, like, yeah, buddy.
In this society, the one opportunity throughout the school week where a child has to interact with his adolescence to find out what it means to wake up in the morning and prepare yourself for the world, they get thrown in front of a television.
In front of a TV.
Yeah, but like...
And normalize addiction.
Right.
And that's back huge. To this point. So that's the Western view of the world, right? So there is... See, I don't see any Western or Eastern addiction, you know, like, people are going to be addicted to different things in different parts of the world. You know, in Eastern parts of the world, they might be addicted to completely different things that to us seem totally benign, but to them could be devastating to their family, their community, their school, their work.
I have two thoughts on that. So in the Eastern world, we had the Opium Wars, and it's kind of interesting that the Opium Wars were actually started by Western civilization as a means to make money, profit. The other thing was related to Sunday school, and we're reading the Bible right now. We finished the Torah, and we're reading Judges. Cool. And in Judges, they show that if a generation is not taught, so if 40 years go by and that generation grows up without being taught the practices that their elders practice, that they fall into a sinliness or worldliness. And so the church, the way I see it, is they focus really hard on getting the youth to study and learn under the tutelage of an adult, like in Sunday school. And from their perspective, it's very important for them, because if you didn't do that, how are these kids supposed to learn?
Well, they're about to get a year. The blessed, the God's chosen people, the Israelites, they're about to get a year to turn their ways. But then after that, salvation is going to be opened up to the Gentiles as well as the chosen people.
What?
You might have to expand on that a little bit. I didn't follow.
So, at this point in the Old Testament, where judges are, the kings and the judges, it's like only the blessed, the God's chosen people can be saved eternally, their soul. But God gives them a year to reform their ways, and they don't end up doing that. If they reform their ways, God was going to keep them, just the blessed ones, available to for eternal salvation. But they didn't, right? So after that year, then through Acts, right? After that
year, that's all the way in the New Testament, isn't it?
No. Then the Gentiles can be saved. Actually, no, you might be right.
This guy read ahead and he's spoiling the Bible, guys.
That's it. But yeah, they were like the youth were rebelling. Everybody was starting to rebel, and this is the beginning of that. And it leads to God trying to forgive them for like a year, saying, okay, you have a year to turn your shit around, and they didn't, right? So this, like, I feel that this is the start of that, of God's people rebelling against him, and then the youth, and then... Every generation after is now pointing at the youth because of what's happening in Judges and saying, like, the youth, man, oh man, they're being led astray. We got to lead them right, you know.
That's an interesting notion, because imagine if that was the origin story of old people hating the youth, right? Like pre-Judges,
yeah. Well, all knew what was somewhere.
We weren't upset.
Yeah, like, these are real human experiences that might be embellished a lot, but they come from somewhere. They come from people. They come from somewhere. Like, somebody wrote this down. Somebody thought of this. And they wouldn't have thought of it if they weren't human, right? So it's a real human experience that was written down, even if it is embellished. There is things to be learned.
For sure.
Oh, absolutely. I think all of us will agree with you there.
Yeah.
Pat, what's sort of whittling away in your mind? You look like you've got something you're pensing about.
No, it's just something to take in, you know? That's really interesting.
All right. Well, then I'm going to take the spotlight again. one of the things my buddy said to me a few weeks ago, which is something that you hear all of the time. Like, you can do anything. Like, it's obvious that you can pretty much do anything. Like we said with that starting quote, everything's impossible until it's done. And the problem isn't the doing, it's the choosing. And the
there's a lot of bad choices.
Well, and there's a lot of good choices, which is even worse than a lot of bad choices. Bad choices are easy to make.
Because of the immobilization factor.
Yeah. And even worse than the good decisions and the bad decisions, it's the indecision.
Well, it's like if you know that you're apt enough to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer, and you don't know if you want to be the fire type, the grass type, or the water type, what do you do? Like, because in the real world, you can't just start being an engineer and then find a wild law degree in the wilderness and throw it against a Pidgey for 10 hours and then have a level 40 Pidgeotto. It just doesn't work like that. And if you followed this metaphor, like, congratulations.
if that's the case, then we fall through the cracks and get shit out the other end. And it's a very tough life. But if we intervene now and we direct, self-direct, make sure we like and find other people to advocate on our behalf, like not because we can't advocate for ourselves, but because it sounds better coming from somebody else. Simply that.
And the other thing too is just experiential data is the best. Like, to an 18-year-old who knows that they could be a doctor, lawyer, or an engineer, what I would say is find a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, and ask them what they think of their life and what they think of their practice. Because at the end of the day, that choice between fire, water, and earth, it's the same choice you make in every video game. It's which choice makes prettier pixels. The pixels are going to deal roughly the same amount of damage. They're going to be roughly as important in the 5-player raid as any other grouping of pixels, but you have to make a choice.
Yeah.
And if you decide that you like dealing with, you know, people that have bones coming out of their body, you're going to be a doctor. And if you discover after your first overnight in the ER that you don't have the stomach for it, maybe you go for law. But you can't make the decision we're being told to make in high school, which is, what are you going to do for the rest of your life in the confines of a school environment filled with adolescents that think they know how the world works, and a bunch of teachers that know that you don't know how the world works? You need to go into the world and see what a job looks like to be able to choose what a job that you want to do. Like, it's the only way. You have to experience it. And as we were saying earlier, the tutelage, like, if you look at Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, he's a pretty famous architect. He had a master and he studied architecture with architects, and then he went off and he did great architect work. And it's like, how are we going to Hermione Granger our way through textbooks to a decision? It just doesn't happen.
You're reminding me a lot of the conversation we had about Urim and Thurman from the Bible. Like, sometimes the decision between ranger, knight, and mage is as simple as, you know, a white or yellow stone.
Tell me a bit about Urim and Thurman.
Well, that was like was it Aaron? He had like the pouch
around his neck. In the breastplate of Aaron, I believe.
Yeah, the breastplate or like a little pouch around his neck or something. He just had two stones. One was white, one was black. One signified yes, one signified no. And like,
but it goes further than that, because it's in The Alchemist too, right?
Yeah.
And then I found out Joseph Smith, the guy who created Mormonism, also alleged to have his own set of Urim and Thurman.
Okay, that's cool. But it also
it's the easiest shill to do.
Yeah, and I also said like it reminds me a lot of like just casting lots in a lot of old paganism or pagan religions, and even deeper into the pagan religions, the two ravens that sat on Odin's shoulders were Hugin and Munin. So like their names sound kind of familiar, just in that way, but like. They represented thought and memory. So one would be like, this is how I remember, this is my growth of knowledge, and this is my, like, how I look forward into the future. So they were, like, both kind of representing a form of divination.
Mm-hmm. But the funnest part about it, too, is, like, you reach into your pouch and you grab one, and that's supposed to be your answer. But if you pick it up and you look at it and it's the wrong answer and you know in your heart it's the wrong answer, then it's also the wrong answer.
Really? So that's the beauty of it. Chill. That's the most perfect chill for divine inspiration.
I have Make a choice. It's one of these two. Oh, I didn't want that one. Okay, it's this one then.
I have a perfect example.
That's also called the magician's choice.
Oh.
See, because, my name is Tim, right? So I'm a drummer, Tim the Magician. I could dabble in a little lyricism. So, like, I know that from studying card and coin illusion that if you choose the wrong one and you just say, oh, my heart chose the other one, that's a magician's choice. That's a force. It's called a force.
Right.
I have a perfect example from a children's cartoon called Avatar the Last Airbender. Where there was an episode with a fortune teller where Katara, she's talking to the fortune teller and she's just like, I have one more question after she's pestering her for hours, getting her fortune told. I have one more question. Should I have mango or papaya for breakfast? And the fortune teller says papaya and she says, ah, I hate papaya and kicks the ground. It's like, you know, deep down what you want, really. It's that forced decision that makes the decision for you, because then you instantly know once the decision has been made for you that that's the one you wanted or the one you didn't want.
And it's interesting, too, because, like, as far as I'm concerned, to a pretty extreme degree, every human on this planet who's got a problem knows that they have a problem, and they're pretty close to knowing what the solution is too. They just don't want to admit it, and they don't want
to take it back to self improvement, right? Recursive self improvement. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah,
I hear you.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Good. All right. To bring it back to recursive self improvement is that you're using that to knowing what you want to bettering yourself, is what Will was bringing. Is it Will?
Will. Yeah. Hi, I'm Will. But then the problem becomes like complete stuckness, you know, like this is all fun and good, but if you're so debilitated that you don't even want to ask a question, if that you don't even want to know what your choices are, like,
yeah, like Pat was bringing up, is that there's just too many options sometimes.
Yeah, where it's like, maybe I'll just Wikipedia something else tonight. Like, let's learn about blue energy.
Snapsy was also touching on those.
Well,
Go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say, I think there are different states of mind that make it easier to practice something versus not knowing what you want. So if you're isolating yourself, because we're psychosocial, biopsychosocial creatures, if you're not taking care of your basic needs, feeding yourself, having good sleep hygiene, taking care of your body, and also networking with other people, if you're isolating, it's going to be really bad for your mind, and you're going to be trapped in this cycle of possibly being addicted to lots of different things, being indecisive, and all of those characteristics of somebody who doesn't have a disciplined practice.
Yeah, like martial arts is very good for discipline.
Yeah, and if you're going to a class, you're networking with other people, interacting.
Yeah, and in like a pandemic, you can't. Yeah, in a pandemic, you can't get that one-on-one sparring experience, right? Like in a classroom environment. So you gotta learn, like through like a test dummy or like.
You gotta learn how to shadow box, in more ways than one.
Yeah.
And I know you could speak to this, Tim, but even being in a band, the way like. Five members have to work together. You have to it's a good balance of having to figure it out on your own and having to work with other people. So I think that's a really valuable learning experience.
If you incorporate music into anything you do, it's going to be a lot easier depending on the choice of music for the task at hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pat, you had something you were going to throw down.
I was going to add something to your point, Will, which is in order to figure out what you want to do, you have to understand your personality. That's another thing that you can learn from.
Know thyself.
Yeah. Whether you're an extrovert, introvert, if you are interested in electronics, but you're terrible at English writing, or vice versa, or whatever others, that's a good way to learn. Take a personality test.
Also, though, on that same wave, knowing the problem doesn't fix anything.
But it is half the battle.
Yep.
Knowing is half the battle.
It certainly does help, but it's not enough on its own.
It might zero the playing field. It might like get you your point of origin.
And you know what? I feel kind of the same way about a lot of religions. You know, it
helps you find your point of origin kind of thing.
It gives you a good starting point, but Nietzsche would say, it kind of locks you in that starting point.
Okay, yeah. So the whole goal is to move beyond that, right? So like you can't just remove a bad habit, right? Just removing a bad habit is like, it's just going to get you to a zero point, right? You got to introduce a good habit.
Exactly. Nature abhors a vacuum. If you get rid of a bad habit, you're just going to, if you don't fill it yourself, you're going to find that you're filled it yourself, but you didn't choose.
And you'll fill it with the exact same thing that you tried to get rid of.
Yeah.
Rush, you know, whether you choose to decide,
you still have made a choice.
You still have made a choice. Yeah.
Free will. Good
the
tune.
The choice you don't make is made for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you mentioned something, Will, about like the don't tell me what you believe, tell me what you practice. I think that might be the next stage that I'm looking for in the separation of church and state. This is the separation of belief and practice.
Church and state are already separated here.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
Vatican, maybe not.
That's what I'm saying.
Southern states.
I'm saying as Canadians,
but here in Canada, we do have a separation.
I'm saying at least like the three of us Canadians, we can say we have accomplished the separation of church and state.
I would argue against that. I would play devil's advocate every day of the week against that, because when you look at
it's definitely a conversation to have. It's a conversation to have, but I don't want to get too far away from what I'm trying to say.
No.
say church and state, you know, Martin Luther, he was stage one. Maybe like Jordan Peterson is actually like starting to unite atheists and Christians in kind of the same room so they can have a conversation at least. I think he's helping with that. But John Vervaeke, I think, takes it a lot further. And I think at some point we have to find another decision to separate some of these things, because church and state isn't enough of a division.
Well, see, I think we're going in the wrong direction, having a separation between church and state. What I feel that we should be having is a de-escalation tactics approach on both church and state, so that their agendas are fundamentally subtly skewed to be more docile and less world endy.
Yeah. I mean,
less apocalyptic.
That's definitely part of it, but I don't know.
I can still hear you. All right, so I'll be following the argument logically.
I mean, de-escalation, that's kind of That is a good idea, but I actually like to know more about how, what you mean by de-escalation.
Well,
how will that work?
Okay, so quickly before I head out, it would be to like, get into positions of high authority on those things, like in government and in church, and then make the thing that they're driven towards a bit less extremist, you know, okay. A bit more secular, I guess, or
yeah. Okay.
But also in the government to be less, you know, regulating. You know, to like sort of replace the government with just like a true democracy of like people depending on each other, interdependency. Anyways.
We're kind of going through that right now here in America, to be honest. In fact, recently, it doesn't really tie into religion at all, but it kind of ties into government and the American people. You know, right now we've been going through 70 days of nonstop riots here in America. And right now, the rest of the country is like sick and tired of it. And they're trying to find ways to de-escalate. And some of them rely on intervention, and others are just defending themselves. A lot of people are defending themselves from these rioters and everything like that. And I can definitely see ways of slowing it down and then coming to a line in the sand and essentially saying, can we just stop with all of this and just think about what we're doing to ourselves, perhaps?
The way I was thinking about it was like pretty much in semantic terms, like back in the day where church and state like weren't really terms to be used. It was just all the same thing. The church was the government. And at this point in time, I think the church is pretending to be a lot of things that it's not. And having a difference between belief and practice, I think, would make a big difference in allowing us to see the church for what it is and not what it pretends to be.
Yeah,
like it's what Jordan Peterson says, like the whole acting as if God exists. Like it's one thing to say you believe in your religion. It's another thing to practice what your religion literally preaches. Yeah. Like,
yeah, exactly. For
me, I know that I don't have an identification with a specific sect of religion. I don't have, like, I'm not a Christian. I'm definitely not a Muslim. I'm certainly not Judaist. I'm not a Jew, okay? But there are practices that come from all of these religions that I incorporate into my existence. And it's that weird thing where, you know, you can believe whatever you want till the cows come home, but if you just do the opposite and you don't practice it, then what's the point? And so, like, the Sabbath, you know, taking a day off every 7 days after working for 6 days, that's a really good idea. Not even for the reasons you think, not because you deserve a rest. You don't, you awful human being. You're a wretch. You deserve to suffer. The point is to clear your head and work better. Because if you don't do the thing that you need to do, you start to think about it. And it's like a dopamine detox. It's like you could binge watch all of Netflix for the next year, or you could spend the next 48 hours not doing anything. And then realizing, wait, I could get my dopamine from reading a book or going for a walk.
My friend, she made me a good luck charm. Say good luck charm, right? And it's a note from my late father to me via my friend writing it, which says, without God, you'd be a shit person that people will hate. And which is true to his belief, right? Because he said to me, like, we're all pieces of shit, you know, but God can help you help you be the cleanest piece of shit. And it makes
what
sense.
A nice man.
He was a really cool. Yeah.
What's your faith, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't have a faith. I'm spiritual for just reality and the pursuit of reality and the pursuit of truth and science. So science is very spiritual to me. Just discovering reality. The fact that we can learn anything about reality at all is very spiritual to me. That's my faith.
Well, would you say you have a worldview that's kind of in line with the original sin doctrine? I mean, kind of similar to what you were saying, all people are shit.
No.
I mean, that's kind of what the Christians think, unless I'm wrong, that, you know, because of Adam's sin.
No, I don't. I think all people are freaking amazing machines capable of great things and capable of terrible things. And like just the seeing of possibilities when we're talking about possibilities, right? That leads to very bad decisions, a lot of bad decisions, because there's a lot of bad possibilities, right? And if you see possibilities, you're likely to end up being a shit human being because you're intelligent. But the wisdom, it's like wisdom itself is even a joke, right? The fact that we can pretend to learn anything about these things is peanuts compared to what the actual truth actually is. And the sooner we give up on this pursuit of truth, right, it seems that we've won the game, we've hacked the game. So that's why it's so easy, in my perspective, for somebody to go straight to a religion, is because they just hacked the game. They just said, we don't even have to pursue truth. We were given truth. We know truth. It was revealed to us. So we don't have to pursue it anymore. But there's that famous quote from like a 15th century poem that Christopher Hitchens quoted in his book, like, God Is Not Great. Is if God handed to me the pursuit of truth and an absolute truth, I'd take the pursuit of truth every time and say, no, Father, absolute truth is for your eyes only.
Yeah, and I can definitely see why we would want to explore different pathways in life and sometimes incorporate our own truths. And just kind of explore what already exists and kind of go beyond those factors and learning about other things within that realm. In fact, before the podcast started, before Will decided to take a shit on it and interrupt him every time. Scott, Tim, and I were talking about whether or not how the universe was made, and different possibilities of how it was made and everything like that. And it just reminded me of that one episode of Cosmos where we might be living in a cell or a bubble.
I'm more a fan of the bubble. So cell. So this is what you're getting at before.
Yeah.
So I'm more a fan of the term bubble, but cell. I can understand the analog to a cell.
Yeah, we might be living inside a cell, in a set of never-ending cells, kind of like in the human body. And how,
but
our
in the human body, it does end.
Yeah.
After a few trillion.
Yeah, I think about 50 trillion cells. So, Pat, in that analogy of the universe being a cell or a bubble, I've had this thought before, like our universe is actually just part of the body of a god or something greater like that. Is that kind of what you were talking about? Because I can't imagine it would be a cell like a bacterium, a unicellular thing, just off on its own, I would imagine they would be part of something else, a multicellular entity kind of working together. What do you think?
At first, I thought about it. But I really don't know. That's kind of a...
What about a cell dedicated to memory? What about a cell dedicated to physical storage of a memory? And we are that.
Yeah, possibly.
Because, like, what is the cell's type, right? Maybe there's different types of cells, and different types of universes fill those different types of functions. But now that we're just speculating, now this is a tangent. So somebody call me out. Somebody call Tangent.
And maybe we're...
Really, I'll call Tangent every day.
Maybe
it's really crazy.
Maybe we're only conscious because we're living inside a brain cell. That's where consciousness comes from.
That's enough.
It's a brain cell.
Yeah, we're brains and bats, and the universe was created last Tuesday.
The Matrix is real.
Like, it doesn't help
this
me.
This was all just thought up last Tuesday. Last Tuesdayism.
It doesn't help me anywhere.
Yeah, like a fish traveling through a river cannot visualize the ocean, so why do we try to visualize where we come from, kind of thing?
It's like in the philosophical discussion, there's a couple conversations going on, and you guys were just hitting on the one that's like, when and where were we existed? And it's like, I don't care about that half. It's like, why and what's right and wrong now that we all accept this notion that we might exist? Like, that's the half.
I think that's the half that I throw away with willful abandon.
Right.
That's the half that I throw away. Is why? Who cares? You know, it works.
Well, it's like the whole notion. Like, why? I had this argument with a family member a couple weeks ago where they were like trying to tell me where the Garden of Eden was, and I was like, whoa, like, that's the first 10 pages. Like, read the other 3,000. The Garden of Eden does not matter in comparison to the big picture. Like, I do not need to know where on this planet Adam and Eve hung out, met a snake, and ate an apple. It just doesn't give me answers.
The Garden of Eden exists in the same place that Atlantis does, in a book and in the zeitgeist. So,
well, I won't make that claim either. You can believe whatever you want. It might be somewhere.
No, that much is irrefutable. Atlantis and the Garden of Eden exist within books and within our minds. They do exist. They are real as concepts. But the rest of it's irrelevant.
So here's a thought that I had based on something I learned called the Jennifer Aniston cell. So have you heard of the Jennifer Aniston cell? All right. No. So now here's my thought, is that everything that you imagine, anything that you can imagine, physically exists in your brain as a group of cells. So every time you think of Jennifer Aniston, there's a group of cells that lights up. So enough people remember Jennifer Aniston in a way that we can say that Jennifer Aniston physically exists. When she dies, when she passes away, heaven is her existence in people's brains.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Right. And that every religion, every god that is collectively believed in physically really exists in people's brains, and when they meditate upon that god, they grow that god in their brain.
This is exactly the concept of the meme from Richard Dawkins. Like, Odin exists because, you know, when you think of Odin, an image of Odin appears in your head involuntarily. Mm-hmm. So that exists within your observable reality.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like hallucinatory evidence, right? Like, it's not ocular data.
Ocular data, even all ocular data is hallucinatory.
That's an interesting argument to make.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go that far.
Our brain
is in a vat. Our brain is in our skull, shielded off from the universe. It can get some low level red light, but other than that, can't get much. It can get some low level red light and some vibrations. But other than that, it's just hallucinating everything.
I wouldn't go down the road of debating that with you, but I disagree.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I think, like, one of the things, I forget his name, but there's this guy, maybe Dottie or something like that. I don't know. But he says, you know, we're all living our own dream. And so when you talk about hallucination, I think that our ocular data is certainly affected by our perceptions of reality. But to go so far as to say that we're all hallucinating in an entirely non-existent plane of reality would be a stretch in my book.
That's not the claim. The claim is that all reality of that data is hallucinated. Because what if the ocular perception of yellow for you is different than the yellow for me? The brain doesn't care. It can just label it yellow because it's a neural network. It doesn't need to be true. The data doesn't need to be true. It just needs to be different, and then it can label it different.
But your
yellow might be different than my yellow through ocular data. Our ocular perception of yellow might be different, but our brain still calls it yellow.
So we're definitely in agreement that the reality is real. We're all experiencing the same reality.
Try turning off your lights at one end of your room and then walking in the dark to your bed. You'll find that you can do because you're hallucinating reality.
Here's the thing. Plato...
You have a mental map of reality.
We talked about this with Plato, too, how, like, light is necessary for sight, in the same way that knowledge is necessary for thinking, or like the faculty of thinking depends on intelligence and knowledge. Like the more of that you have, the better you're able to perceive reality, and the more light you have, the better you're able to see reality. That doesn't do anything about how reality exists, just in how we perceive it.
Yeah.
What are you thinking, Synapsian?
I think there is definitely some kind of reality that we can measure through, you know, objective science. But then what you're talking about, Tim, is this idea that we conceive reality more often than we perceive it. Because, you know, take for our sight, for example, we have a 3-degree cone that we can see in high definition. And outside of that 3-degree cone, everything's peripheral vision. We have more neurons going towards the eye than coming in from the outside. So we're actually set up to conceive a reality, that is to generate ideas that we may not actually be taking from our senses. We're generating a world, essentially dreaming in a way, but to distill it down to the base, I think it's just we tend to conceive reality more than we perceive it, and the goal should be to attempt to perceive what is in front of us. And you could do that through meditating, just sitting still, opening your eyes.
I see what you're saying, but I'm actually saying, like, even a step further, that the light that comes into our eyes gets turned into a chemical signal, and then that chemical signal gets relayed to our brain. So our brain has hallucinated a photon when that photon never actually went to our brain. It was just chemical relay, and a lot can go wrong in between that. But because brains are the way brains are, like brain cells, the way are like a neural network is, it's almost like magic. So that's why kids can have unassisted learning and still learn things, just by seeing what the problem is. And then just by sheer number of neurons can create a solution to a problem that they didn't know existed moments before. and then they know the problem exists, and then they come up with a solution, like seemingly out of nowhere, right? So same thing with like reality coming in. If anything goes wrong, the brain can do some miracle magic work and make reality make sense to the conscious. Like
it's like the perception. Idea of it's like the idea of speed reading.
Like yeah, a hoax.
When you're speed reading, you don't like read every single word. You basically just the first couple of letters of every word, and then your brain just ends up filling it all in on its own. And sometimes when you see a word that you've never seen before, your brain deciphers it as something else, and you just skip by it without noticing until it starts not to make any comprehensive sense. Then you have to go fix it.
Yeah, so fixing something takes a lot more work than getting it right the first time, right? So that's why speed reading can be seen as a hoax. But you can jump in and mine out certain information points.
Let me tell you about a photographic really memory quickly. In 60 pages per hour. Very effective. Very effective. I would like to use that tool that I saw come about like 8 years ago. That's where they take the center point of the word and highlight it a different color than the rest of the letters of the word, and they fire tens of thousands of words over the course of a minute just into one location, so you don't have to move your eyes. Because a lot of reading has to do like we get slowed down when we move our eyes and refocus, and that's why when you look at ancient, you know, religious sects, they knew that, and they didn't write words on a page. They wrote symbols on a page so that you could look at a wall of hieroglyphs and retain an entire encapsulation of multiple events, or open a page of a book and remember the symbolism. And then the symbolism, much like your sort of mind castle, allows you to store data points at a level that is completely abstracted from literacy, but allows you to interpret massive quantities, like terabytes of literal text.
I see what you're saying, though. That's like a lot of those memory techniques involve pictures, right? So what you're saying with the hieroglyphs, with the pictures, right, is that they mean a certain portion of the story, right? So that, because like I've trained with the memory thing, right? And like, yeah, like you can look at a wall and see like terabytes of data, right? Through oral things written down through pictures, right? But you still need to do the slow reading and do the memory part of it, right? Even if it takes you 4 seconds for each character, you still got to sit there and go through it. But once you know it, it's there for reference, right? So we can effectively become smarter by reducing the load on our already existing IQ, and we can do that by writing things down, whether in English or hieroglyph. And as soon as it's written down, it can be looked up, it can be referenced. So Einstein said that he didn't bother committing things to memory that can be referenced, that can be looked up. Right.
Yeah.
So he was saving his IQ. He said, like, I just had a regular IQ. Like I was not a smart man. I just used my intellect, you know, in a very deliberate way.
Yeah, and that can call back to the old conversations between Socrates and Plato, or hypothetical conversations between Socrates and Plato, where Socrates would argue that you can't start writing everything down that you know, because then you wouldn't be able to cultivate a memory at all, because everything would just be reference points laying around you.
That was the fear.
Yeah.
But yet society came out with writing, and writing was fine. And then same thing when the printing press came out, people burned that shit down. They burnt the printing presses down. The Luddites, right?
Well, they also discovered that they were blind when we created the printing press, right? It spurred the revolution of glasswork. There was a few factors at play, but essentially They started printing the Bible, and we found out very quick that we couldn't read. And so I think it was in Italy where the government put all of the glassmakers on an island and told them and their families that they were never allowed to leave. And so they were forced to compete with each other. At the same time, the printing press was being developed. And at that time, our glass wasn't clear. And so they were searching the world for the right seaweed to make clear glass. And around the exact same time, we got lots of Bibles. We created the half sphere that magnifies text.
Hmm.
Wow. That's
interesting.
Yeah.
Just another perfect example of how technology pushes itself forward.
I do have to take off in a couple minutes here, though, guys.
Yeah, so, we've been going for about an hour.
Before we go, maybe I don't know if you guys want to just mention what you guys are doing today to push yourself forward. Where's your path taking you today or this week?
Good call.
Yeah, totally. I'm doing an hour and a half of hot yoga later.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
And then
I've been meaning to actually record on a video recording of a short yoga session, so I think I'm going to try that.
Nice.
Yeah, right on. Like an instructional video?
Yeah, just like it'll be really short. It's kind of for like a junior youth group thing, and maybe 10 minutes at the most. And then I'll probably try to catch up with Akira the Don, because he's just been putting out like mad content.
Oh yeah, streaming every day.
I can't keep up with him. I don't know how he does it, but yeah, he just keeps on going.
It's unreal. We can barely get together twice a week to record. How does he do it every single day?
Yeah.
So me, for me to move forward, I'm realizing I don't have to do anything to move myself forward. The pursuit of self-improvement itself is a futile exercise and a cause of a lot of misery. And life will move forward upon me. And it is just up to me to just prepare myself and be still and be ready for whatever does come next, not to push myself forward when I might not be ready.
That kind of sounds like you're riding the wave, like you're surfing.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
Playing defense almost.
no defense, just preparedness. But yeah, preparedness is defense. Yeah, I guess.
Problem I find with going with the flow is if this is the river, and then this is this little part of the river, and you're going with the flow, and then you get stuck here and you spin around in a circle, you're still going with the flow, but you're not actually going anywhere. And that's my big fear with sort of being prepped for life versus making
I feel that my whole point's been taken out of context here. That is not me. Do not associate me with that.
Good.
Well, I do have a perspective on flow real quick, is that you have like you got like a T right here, and then you got adrenaline up here, you have acetylcholine down here, you have cortisol here, the stress hormone, then is dehydroepiandrosterone over here, DHEA. They put it like a precursor to it, DHA and yogurt, like kids yogurt, make them happy. Anyways, anything that is in the DHA zone, whether it's acetylcholine or adrenaline, this up here is like the athlete's focused, hyper-focused. Down here is meditation, you know, very rhythmic heart rate from the DHEA, right? But cortisol over here is anxiety, like up top here with high adrenaline, high cortisol, low DHEA. That's anxiety. And down here with low adrenaline, high acetylcholine, ACH, that's boredom, right? With an irregular heartbeat with the cortisol, right? So just getting to zero, you can get to zero with regular breathing, because you can't control your heart rate directly, but you can control your breathing, right? So once you get a regular breath, you can get you can promote a regular heart rate. Once you promote a regular heart rate, you can promote regular brain waves. And then that can allow you to focus and deal with life as it comes, because life will happen anyways. You don't need to push yourself forward in any special way. There are going to be plenty of opportunities to do good and plenty of opportunities to do harm come my way. So my realization is that I don't need to be pushing myself forward every day, but I just need to be prepared to deal with shit that comes my way.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The Pat, what are you going to do?
Yeah, what have you been up to, Pat?
It's kind of a similar fashion of what Tim was talking about. Is for me, I'm just going to follow wherever the story goes.
And you were talking to story-driven, too, like falling in love with storytelling.
Yeah, I'm currently revising a novel right now, and there's plenty of mistakes. There's plenty of things that don't make sense, but I'm just simply just following along with it, even if I may not get the answer to it. If there's no answer to it, then that's fine. If it can be scrapped, that's fine. If there's something that comes up that will lead the story forward, then I'll follow that and see where it goes.
Either way, it sounds like it's a source of meaning for you, so.
It is.
Yeah.
And maybe speaking of stories, we should mention what books we're reading for the next book wave.
We're just on To Kill a Mockingbird, the Book of Judges in the Bible, and eventually we're going to get around to Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Heck yeah. I got to run, guys. Good chat. Right. Okay, thanks. Bye.
All right. See you, Will.
Good talk, lads.
Yeah. All right. So I guess we'll just close it off here. So, till next time, may the force be with you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Tim, for stopping by. And also, if you're new around here, you should check out our website at www.bookwave.club. Anchor, YouTube, Akira the Dawn, Meaning Wave. Shout out to our boy. And, till next time.
Later.